From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with journalist Laura Silber, co-author of the new book Yugoslavia, Death of a Nation. She's covered the Balkans for 8 years. We'll focus on the role Slobodan Milosevic, the president of Serbia, played in orchestrating the war and in ending it, and the people he was willing to see sold out or slaughtered along the way. Also, an actor reflects on the work of Orson Welles. We talk with Simon Callow about his new biography of Welles. Callow is best known for his role in Four Weddings and a Funeral. His character was the one whose funeral is referred to in the title. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The peace agreement between the leaders of Serbia, Croatia, and Bosnia has held, but it is fragile. Richard Holbrooke, the Assistant Secretary of State, who was a key peace negotiator, is in Sarajevo trying to prevent the agreement from unraveling. My guest Laura Silber is the co-author of the new book Yugoslavia, Death of a Nation, which is the companion to the documentary series broadcast recently on the Discovery Channel. Silber has covered the Balkans for the past 8 years for the Financial Times of London. Her book traces how Slobodan Milosevic, the president of Serbia, consciously manipulated nationalist feelings and pushed the Balkans into war in order to expand his power. I asked Laura Silber who Milosevic was before he became president of Serbia.
Milosevic came to power first in an attempt to step into Tito's shoes, and he was the first communist leader. He was actually just sort of a faceless apparatchik, and he was the first one who dared to use the nationalist card, to play it, and he sensed, when he first dared to do it after that, he sensed its power, and he saw that it could somehow reinvigorate the bloodless communist party. And his position was something that nobody else in Yugoslavia had had since the death of Tito. And that was, he was adored. He was seen as the national leader of the Serbian people. And so when he moved later to try and take over Yugoslavia and centralize it, that was something that the other leaders in the republics other than Serbia and Montenegro couldn't handle.
You say no one else had dared to use the nationalist card before that. Why wouldn't anyone else play on nationalist loyalties in Yugoslavia?
One of the problems with former Yugoslavia was that nationalist issues and cultural, even the subject of cultural identity, was largely suppressed rather than dealt with or diffused somehow. So that in the 50 years, we still had some problems, obviously, between the national communities, and the communists just didn't allow people to express their national identity. And that was why he was the only one who dared to use it. He realized it was what he needed to really revive the Communist Party.
How did he orchestrate nationalism early on?
He made a trip to Kosovo Polje, and Kosovo is what Serbs see as the seat of their civilization. It's a largely ethnic Albanian province in southern Serbia. And he went there on a pledge, and he pledged to restore the rights to Serbs there. Serbs there saw themselves as an oppressed majority, oppressed in terms of a majority in Serbia, but a minority in Kosovo. And they saw themselves as having no rights. Now, this isn't quite true, but that was the way they perceived themselves. And Milosevic went down there, and he promised that he would restore their dignity. And they felt that no one else had dared to say that. And therefore, he slowly turned over, and he did that everywhere in Serbia first, in the autonomous province of Kosovo, in the northern autonomous province of Vojvodina, and slowly worked his way through any Serb region in Montenegro, and even in parts of former Yugoslavia. He tried to maximize his hold on power and really play on all the Serbs distributed throughout Yugoslavia.
Did you attend any of those rallies? Could you call them rallies?
Yeah, you could call them rallies. I attended quite a few rallies conducted by Slobodan Milosevic or by various socialist leaders. Later on, he would leave it to other people to carry out the rallies. And it was almost like a religious revival. It was something that was fervent, and people would travel for hours, and they would travel for hours and hours to come to these rallies. And in some cases, they were even paid to come. And that was how Milosevic got the machine working, was that they were either bussed in from the factories or they were offered some sort of financial incentive. They were given maybe free lunches or drinks. And that was how they got the machine moving. But then it took on a life of its own, and that these people really, they flocked to these rallies by choice. And they flocked to them because they felt it was giving them the right to say who they were. And so he was playing on some sentiments that had actually been long whispered in Serbia. And he gave Serbs the impression that they could speak out loud again and say they were Serbs. Yet, at the same time, there was this terribly dangerous component to this nationalism. Dangerous in the sense of Serbs were the biggest nation in former Yugoslavia, and it was in some sense their responsibility to be sensitive to the others. The next biggest nation is the Croats, and they're less than half the size of the Serbs. And so all the other nations felt dominated, and they felt threatened by this growing beast of Serbian nationalism.
Do you think Milosevic had any goal besides accumulating more personal power? And do you think of him as truly being motivated by Serbian nationalist feelings?
No, I think that was actually a big misperception in the West. Milosevic doesn't care about Greater Serbia. He cared about more power. That was exclusively his motivation. He sensed that the national card was the one to play. Milosevic does not believe in anything but power. And that's what makes him such a tough player. And that's, in a way, now what makes him the most cooperative player. He senses that his star is now tied to Washington, ironically, that he can now maximize his power, maintain himself in power, maintain his control over Serbia by being cooperative, by carrying out the Dayton Agreement. And that's why Milosevic was both the most difficult to deal with, but also now is the easiest to deal with, in that it's only power. It's not a sense of belief, whereas President Franjo Tuđman of Croatia really believes in his messianic mission to give the Croatian people a Croatian state. Milosevic doesn't have that same sense of mission.
Milosevic managed to basically take over the Yugoslavian National Army and use it to establish Serb power. How did he do that?
He did it actually with a great degree of difficulty. One thing, I think that's another misperception that we had. The Yugoslav National Army, for a long time, really was defending Yugoslavia. It was defending Tito's communist ideology. It wasn't defending Milosevic, and it was only after he had basically put so much pressure on the army, he basically tried to bully them into carrying out a coup. The army refused to it. Veljko Kadijević, who is half Croat, half Serb, but really basically a Yugoslav communist, he was the one who refused repeatedly to carry out a coup. But it was almost a Hamlet kind of dilemma. He just couldn't make up his mind. And so Kadijević eventually was dragged into the war in Croatia, but it was almost unwillingly. And then we have a series of purges in the Yugoslav army, purges of the people who identified with Yugoslavia, people who were not going to be readily under control of Milosevic for his what then became his nationalist goals, because that was how he saw that he could maximize his power.
What relationship did he create between the Yugoslav National Army, which he virtually took over, and the army of the Bosnian Serbs?
Well, what he did was basically he pulled the wool over everybody's eyes. Yugoslavia in May 1992, that was about a month after the war had started in Bosnia, they said, we're withdrawing the Yugoslav army from Bosnia. Bosnia is an independent state. We don't have anything to do with it. But in secret, what they had done in January, so that's 4 months before the outbreak of war, they had transferred all Yugoslav army officers who were native Serbs from Bosnia, had transferred them all back to Bosnia. Therefore, they had thousands of men, officers in position, ready to join the Bosnian Serb army when the Yugoslav army formally withdrew in May 1992. They had an army ready-made.
Now, did that help the Bosnian Serbs in their arming also?
Well, sure. They inherited all the weaponry. Oh. The Yugoslav army, when they left, they didn't bring it with them. They left it to the Bosnian Serbs. And, of course, well, what the Milosevic answered, well, that's theirs. We can't take it from them. They have it. Well, in fact, they had a ready-made army, and that's what the Bosnian government didn't have. And that's what the Croats didn't have, but acquired in the 2 to 3 years that it took to get to now.
And that's why the arms embargo hurt the Bosnians much more than it hurt the Bosnian Serbs, because the Bosnian Serbs already had the arms from the Yugoslavian army.
I think that's right. But one of the things about the arms embargo, which is a common misperception, the arms embargo was largely implemented, in fact, by the Croats. The Croats didn't let the arms get through to the Bosnian government. The Croats managed to arm themselves in spite of an arms embargo.
My guest is Laura Silber, co-author of the new book, Yugoslavia, Death of a Nation. She's the Balkan correspondent for the Financial Times in London. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Laura Silber, co-author of the new book, Yugoslavia, Death of a Nation. What do you think Milosevic finally gained by the war?
I think Milosevic gained nothing from the war, and I think that's something that the Serbs haven't yet realized, is in fact they lost the war because they lost what was a centuries-long presence of Serbs in Croatia that no longer exists. There's next to no Serbs who were allowed to remain there. And the Bosnian Serbs, many of them have left the country. Many of them have lost their homes. Republika Srpska, the Serb territory in Bosnia, has been sent back decades in terms of development, in terms of cultural, just total destruction of what was really a patchwork of Muslims, Croats, and Serbs living together. These people are now living in conditions that are unbelievable, you know, that they don't have, very few people have their cars or they're on foot. And it really, when you walk around there, you feel like you've gone back at least a few decades. And I think that that sense of defeat will be felt more and more in Serbia. Serbia itself was under sanctions for 3.5 years. The economy was totally destroyed also by the price of footing the bill for the wars in Croatia, for the wars in Bosnia. And I think Milosevic has gained very little except that he's been able to stay in power. And that's what's important to him.
Is he still popular?
Yes, and that's the real irony. He's popular. People see him as the one who was able to keep Serbia proper out of war. And I think that's something that the people of Serbia appreciate, and they don't see that he was the one who waged war. Because Milosevic controls the state media, and the television is really the only thing that people watch. He's been able to have a hold over what people think in Serbia, and he's been able to really determine the political temperature. And now that Milosevic has decided that nationalism is no longer the card to play, people are just relieved that there's a peace, and they believe that Milosevic is responsible for delivering that peace.
What can you tell us about Milosevic's relationship with the political leader of the Bosnian Serbs, Karadzic?
Well, his relationship actually changed, obviously, over the years. At the beginning, you could see that Karadzic absolutely adored Milosevic. And I remember talking to Karadzic, it was in 1992, and he said, "Oh, you Westerners, you all hate Milosevic so much. He's not so bad. He's fighting for us. He's helping us." And then later on, you saw this slowly, Karadzic betraying somehow that he felt that Milosevic had betrayed him. But it was only later that he dared, only this year, that Karadzic has actually dared to speak publicly against Milosevic, because he knows that Milosevic is the one who holds all the cards in his hand.
Did he help Karadzic become the political leader of the Bosnian Serbs?
It's not so much that Milosevic himself selected Karadzic, but what Milosevic's people helped select Karadzic. And Karadzic himself actually was rather a reluctant leader. At the beginning, he didn't see himself as the one who was going to lead the Bosnian Serbs. He thought that there were other people who were more likely to become the leader. And then you saw Karadzic, I mean, physically changing as he grew bigger, as he became more convinced of his mission, and became more convinced that he was the one who was carrying out the historical formation of the Bosnian Serb state. And then later on, now, when Milosevic has decided he's had enough of Karadzic, you've seen Karadzic turn into this wild-eyed, wild-haired, strangely hunted leader who really, you can physically sense that he knows his days are numbered.
Now, your feeling is that the Dayton peace agreement was signed because Milosevic was ready to stop the war. Why was he ready to go along with an agreement?
He wanted to get sanctions lifted. He wanted to make sure that Karadzic was finished once and for all. He wanted Serbia to rejoin the international community just because the economy was really at rock bottom. And he had calculated long before, actually, I think Washington was probably a bit slow to recognize, a year before Milosevic was ready to make a deal. The only thing is that because of what happened on the ground, that the Serbs were so divided, that they were chased out of Krajina in Croatia, and that the enclave Srebrenica fell, making it that the Muslims and the Croats in the West could push forward. And I think it was a combination of the Milosevic's political will and the reality, the changing map on the ground, which made it much easier to secure an agreement at Dayton. And Milosevic was the one who was really willing to make concessions. He gave up Sarajevo. He told Ali Izetbegović, you were there, you deserved it, you stuck it out for 4 years while they were battering you. But with that handing over of Sarajevo to the Bosnian government, what he did also was made sure that Radovan Karadzic's power base was permanently destroyed.
Do you think that this is an unusual peace agreement in that the heads of state are still the heads of state?
Yes, it is. And it's even more unusual in the fact that the heads of state would still be elected the next time around. It's very rare that you have the heads of state oversee the total destruction of everybody's lives in one way or another. And yet, probably all of them will be reelected when they run in the next campaign. I think, though, that because we're interested in getting some sort of stability, that probably the calculation is Milosevic and Tudjman, who with the help of Washington has become the second strong man in the Balkans, will somehow be the ones who can carry out the agreement. Now, what I fear is that these two men have nothing in common with democracy, and ultimately, a Bosnia can't survive between an undemocratic and potentially expansionist Croatia and Serbia.
I believe you've been covering the Balkans for 8 years, is that right?
That's right.
So that means you were covering it back when it was still Yugoslavia. You covered the descent into war, covered the war, and now the peace.
That's right. And I hope that when I leave, that there'll still be a peace. Yeah, I mean, I came actually at the same time as Milosevic came to power. So I've had the opportunity to see him change his skin time and time again, see him become from a communist apparatchik, this colorless gray man, to becoming this nationalist leader, and now to becoming someone who's courted by the West. And it's been an amazing thing just to see that up close and to meet him and have Milosevic sort of slouched in his chair telling you that you can speak in whatever language that he wants and see that charm that I think really helped ensnare the European mediators and see what he does to them and how he just looks them in the eyes and he just tells them that he can take care of everything. And I think that's something that we don't see from the outside, that we don't see that Milosevic has this ability to just promise the world, and he delivers only when he wants to.
Tell me more about what it's like to interview him, especially when deeper into the war, when you knew that whatever charm he was turning on, he was responsible for horrible atrocities.
Well, the problem with Milosevic is that when you talk to him, you don't see it's... You know that he's responsible for these atrocities, but he's very engaging. He's very smart. He's very quick on his feet. And I know that a lot of the mediators, Ambassador Holbrooke has described that, this idea of you're sitting in the room with a man who's carried out such crimes. But at the same time, he's someone who's always making jokes and making his guests feel at home and feeding them meals of roast lamb and red wine and homemade rakia, which is a local brandy. And that he's really convinces them that he's someone that they can talk to. And I think what happened over the years is that people would walk away and then they realized that they had been lied to over a 5-hour lunch.
Did you ever talk to him about what was actually happening in the war? I mean, try to hold him accountable personally in a one-on-one interview for the war atrocities.
No, I haven't. Milosevic is someone who doesn't like to give interviews at all. So when I finally got one with him, I felt that it was best to create it as a non-confrontational setting. Milosevic is someone that I've seen many people interview him, if they accuse him of war crimes, he's so defensive and he's so unwilling to continue the interview, to go on talking, that I don't think it's necessarily, in terms of a journalistic sense, that you'll get the best results.
So what did you talk to him about?
Well, what I was doing was for the book, and I wanted him to say what happened and to tell it in his words, how he made some of the key decisions from 87 on, rather than saying, I hold you morally accountable.
Right.
I asked him, what did you do?
And did he lie a lot?
Oh, yes. I mean, to the point of when he talks to you, he acts completely convinced that he's always been just fighting for peace. And it's those bad guys who are the ones who are waging war. And at one point he turned to me and he said, and what's really absurd is that we here were accused of nationalism. Imagine that.
Wow.
And you look at him and you just have to say, have to smile, because he looks at you as if he believes it.
So what's the next step for you? Are you going to continue to cover the Balkans?
I think I'll probably leave by the end of this year and actually move back to New York.
Well, I wish you a good trip when you do. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Laura Silber is the co-author of Yugoslavia, Death of a Nation. She's the Balkan correspondent for the Financial Times in London. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, an actor reflects on the work of Orson Welles. We talk with Simon Callow about his new biography of Welles. Callow's own acting experience includes playing Reverend Beebe in A Room with a View and playing the character who is buried at the end of Four Weddings and a Funeral. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Simon Callow is the only actor I can think of who has explored his craft by writing biographies of actors. He wrote an acclaimed book about Charles Laughton, and now the first in his two-volume biography of Orson Welles has just been published. This volume ends with the completion of Citizen Kane, considered by many to be among the best films ever made, which Welles directed, starred in, and co-wrote. Callow was best known to Americans through his roles as the villain in Ace Ventura, When Nature Calls, the character who's buried in Four Weddings and a Funeral, and the Reverend in A Room with a View. Callow writes that Welles worked hard as a director, but never really pushed himself hard as an actor. He simply accepted that he had the temperament and physique to be a leading actor.
He knew that he had certain great natural endowments, a voice the like of which no other actor has had this century, I would say, of commanding physique. You know, he was 6'2" and tremendously broadly built, a very, very powerful, imposing man. And he was very, very intelligent. And he more or less brought these three gifts to his performances. But there was no question of him searching within himself for the character. And there was not terribly much ambition in terms of the actual physical gesture of the character. He had a view that acting essentially consisted of suppressing certain elements of yourself. And in addition, putting on things like noses and various, in fact, large quantities of makeup. But the next stage of that, which is an approach favoured by many actors, which is generally to then give in to the thing that you've created. You put on your false nose, you put on your makeup, you look in the mirror, you see somebody else looking back at you, and you start to become that other person. That last bit was the bit Welles resisted. He didn't want that. He wanted to be in control all the time, so that he was on top of the character, as it were, presenting the character to the audience at one remove.
Do you think because his personality was so outsized, he didn't want to make it subservient to the character's personality?
I think that's right. And I think he also had developed this, as you say, outsized personality, and was the last thing he wanted to do was to investigate alternative possibilities of who or what he might have been. This was it. This was the Orson Welles that he wanted to be, and he stuck with it.
You know, I'm a big fan of your earlier biography of Charles Laughton. And as I was telling you before we recorded the interview, a quote of Laughton's that I quite like is Laughton saying, people don't know what they're like, but I think I can show them, which I think beautifully sums up acting at its best. When I mentioned this, my admiration for this quote to you, you said this is something that Orson Welles would never say.
Yes, absolutely.
Why not?
He didn't believe, he didn't think of acting or indeed the theatre as a mirror of human life in the way that Laughton obviously did, and to some extent that Brecht, to whom Laughton made the remark, did. Instead, Welles, I believe, saw it as the telling of big fables, which to some extent gave a model of human life. But in no sense, I believe, did he think that it was a personal statement or a personal revelation. Whereas Laughton absolutely fed off his own inner life to an extraordinary degree, to an almost morbid degree, but to a degree that meant that his finest performances are piercingly human and disturbing in a way that nothing, I think, that Welles as an actor ever did. This is not that, you must understand, to denounce Welles as an actor. He had many remarkable qualities and was a very exhilarating performer on many occasions. But what Laughton was trying to do, I suspect, was more creative than what Welles was attempting, more creative and more courageous, and in the end cost him more, a price that Welles wasn't prepared to pay or didn't think worth paying.
Now, Welles didn't push himself hard as an actor, but he sure seemed to push the actors who he was directing really hard, particularly in Citizen Kane, where he did take after take after take until he felt that it was exactly what he wanted.
Absolutely. When I say he didn't push himself very hard, I mean, he was, frankly, a rather lazy actor. That's in a nutshell, what Welles was. But he did push himself quite far physically sometimes, and He certainly pushed his actors very far physically. If there was a sequence that involved coordinated action, then Wells would work it and work it and work it. But Wells was by no means of the persuasion of, shall we say, Stanislavski or Harold Clurman or even a Guthrie McClintock. He didn't actually require the actors to delve into themselves. He didn't. He wasn't challenging the truth, as it were. What he was challenging was the physical execution.
Well, he even transformed himself for Citizen Kane. What did he do to make himself the handsome young man that he thought Kane needed to be for the performance?
Yes. Wells was, even as a young man, in a constant struggle with his waistline. And for the early Kane, he, first of all, was taking quite a lot of dietary tablets, which were mostly amphetamines. And he was wearing a fierce corset. And his whole face was pulled back with the use of fish glue. He gave himself, as it were, a face lift with makeup. Maurice Seideman, his makeup artist, devised this incredible sort of cage to pull back, rather in the manner of the later Marlene Dietrich, to pull the whole of the muscular face back. And indeed, he looks pretty dazzling as a result of it. But he was very funny about it in later life. Norman Mailer had said of him that he was, at that age, the most beautiful young man who had ever lived. And Wells very self-mockingly said, but it took 5 hours to get it that way.
Right. Do you mind talking about Citizen Kane? Because I know you started off to write about the theater life of Orson Welles, not his film life.
Oh, I'm delighted. Nothing pleases me more. After all, the book is called The Road to Xanadu, and Xanadu is where Citizen Kane exists. So the whole point, really, of my... Once I'd changed my idea of writing a biography was just to show how all that early life and all that theatre fed into his work on the screen. And it's fascinating that the cinematographer that he worked with, Greg Toland, favoured long takes and wasn't keen on a fussy cutting technique where you keep cutting away to people.
Well, let me back up a second here. When Orson Welles made Citizen Kane, it was his first movie. He'd just come to Hollywood. He hadn't acted on screen before. He certainly hadn't directed before. And so he had to surround himself with talented people. And one of the people who he worked with was Greg Toland, the cinematographer, who had done what other films? What, Wuthering Heights, Grapes of Wrath?
And most importantly, a film called The Long Voyage Home for John Ford, which is where he began the experiment that he continued with Kane, experimenting with deep focus photography, using ceilings and all of that stuff.
Yeah, explain a little more what this approach to deep focus was and why it was unusual at that time.
Well, the prevailing cinematographic language was one of in which there was an attempt to distill a kind of pleasing, realistic picture. The idea was to make it look like life. And what Toland favoured was a much more dramatic conception, much more visually charged, so as you could, for example, have a scene in which people were a long way apart from each other, but both was in focus. Whereas normally the sort of lenses and the sort of lighting that was favoured by the mainstream cinematography was to favour the close up and the foreground figure, so as a background figure would be in soft focus. What it does is to make the dynamic impact of each frame hugely greater. It's quite a shock. Every frame of Citizen Kane punches you between the eyes. That's what Toland thought cinematography should be. Curious enough, he thought that was more realistic than the other approach to cinema. But in fact, we now feel that it's very intensified and indeed somewhat expressionistic, which is really where the techniques evolved in the German cinema of the 20s and 30s and early 30s.
Did Toland's cinematography work well with Wells' experience as a man of the theater?
Oh, tremendously, because Wells was, you might say, for the most part, he was a sort of expressionist theatre director, and he favoured the extreme contrasts in lighting that is also characteristic of the expressionist cinema, and he used shadows a great deal, which is another very, very common feature of that kind of shooting. And what he strove for in the theatre was exactly what Tolan strove for in film, which was maximum expressive impact. So as you were absolutely electrified by the physical production of a Welles show. You were absolutely hit between the eyes by it.
Something happened between that chemistry of Tolan and Welles working together that might not have happened if Tolan was working himself or Welles was working without Tolan.
Absolutely. They were made for each other. It was a fabulous partnership, and one of the great sadnesses of the American cinema and of Welles' career is that they never worked together again. Tolan died early, only a couple of years after Citizen Kane was completed, and Welles' second film, The Magnificent Ambersons, which was shot by another extraordinarily distinguished cinematographer called Stanley Cortez, was of a totally different temperament. Tolan was quick, sharp, extremely ambitious in what he wanted to do. Cortez was a rather meditative man, slow to set things up, a perfectionist and a poet. And these were really not very good qualities for Welles. When Cortez later shot The Night of the Hunter for Charles Laughton, he had found his perfect director. And so that is Cortez's masterpiece in exactly the same way that Citizen Kane is Tolan's masterpiece.
Simon Callow is my guest, and he's written a new biography of Orson Welles, actually volume one of that biography. Simon Callow is also an actor, best known now, I guess, for Four Weddings and a Funeral. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with actor Simon Callow, who's also written volume one of a new biography of Orson Welles. Another great collaborative relationship in Citizen Kane is between Orson Welles and screenwriter Herman Mankiewicz. Of course, Welles gets so much of the credit for Citizen Kane. Where does Mankiewicz come in, and how much of the screenplay do you think was his?
Bluntly speaking, the whole idea of Citizen Kane was Mankiewicz's. And most of the writing in it was Mankiewicz shared with John Houseman at the earliest stages. Welles functioned brilliantly as an editor. He will have cut it and shaped it. He probably contributed certain scenes, certain ideas. I know, for example, absolutely it was his concept that Kane and his first wife should age together sitting around a breakfast table. That absolutely dazzling sequence is pure Welles. As he later said, he took the idea from a short play by Thornton Wilder called The Long Christmas Dinner. And that's absolutely the sort of contribution that Welles was making all the way through the film. But if we're talking about line for line, word for word, the actual writing in the script is largely Herman Mankiewicz.
As you write in your book, Pauline Kael had said about Citizen Kane that Herman Mankiewicz put in so many details about Welles' life within the screenplay that a lot of critics later assumed, well, this was just like Welles assuming a certain amount of autobiography and projecting that onto the character, and consequently, Welles got some of the credit that Mankiewicz really should have gotten. Do you agree with that perception?
Yes, I think that's quite accurate. And you should add Houseman to the list of people who added in those autobiographical details. When Houseman and Mankiewicz withdrew, because Mankiewicz had this rather sizable drink problem, they withdrew from Los Angeles to a little place outside of the city, and they pursued a very strict regime where Mankiewicz, and indeed Houseman, were allowed one drink at 7 o'clock at night. So Mankiewicz was writing extremely well, and Mankiewicz and Houseman together hit it off marvellously. It was typically mischievous of Herman Mankiewicz to insist that Hausmann should collaborate, knowing how much it would annoy Wells, because Wells and Hausmann had really broken up their partnership by then, but Mankiewicz insisted that Hausmann must be part of the writing process, and Hausmann and Mankiewicz, almost literally like naughty boys, sat down making these jokes at their boss's expense, their boss being something like 15 years younger than one and 10 years younger than the other, whom they dubbed the Dog Boy for some reason, and rather slyly interpolated all these details from Wells's life. Whether Wells himself was aware of what was going on is rather hard to say.
You describe Wells as being almost ruthless at rehearsals because he'd rehearse his actor so much and then have him do take after take until he felt the scene was perfect.
Yeah.
What can you tell us about what the rehearsals were like and what interests you about them as an actor yourself?
You mean the rehearsals for Caine?
For Caine.
Well, first of all, he did a lot of rehearsal, which is quite an unusual thing in film. It was unusual then, as still unusual. He sort of stole time out of the studio schedules by pretending that they were just read-throughs, and they were really very clearly and vividly planned and rehearsed before they got in front of the camera. As I said, Toland's cinematography played very well into Wells's theatrical experience because he wasn't interested. One of the first things you have to decide as a director is how you're going to dispose the shots in the scene. How are you going to break it down? So, you know, is the camera going to be on me during my speech and then cut to somebody else? Will we have a wide shot? Will we have a close-up? All that grammar of film is very hard to master. Fortunately, Toland, as I said, favoured rather long takes in which the camera followed the actors. So Wells could stage the thing however he liked, more or less as he would do on a stage in the theatre. And then Toland devised the camera movement, which would follow them round. So there are wonderful sequences, like the party at the Enquirer, in which the camera it never stops moving and follows everyone. It's a long time before you actually get a cut to anything. And so that terrible anxiety, I speak from experience, since I've directed a movie, and one of the hardest things for me to really come to terms with was the question of the breakdown of the shots. But Wells didn't really have that problem. And indeed, it made it a great deal easier for editing, too, because by and large, the editing was sort of done in the camera. The Robert Wise, who edited it, didn't really have all that much to do. It had all been shot in the camera. Instead of having acres and acres of footage in which you decide, shall I cut away to this or cut away to that? On the contrary, in Caine, the scenes really hold from beginning to end.
My guest is actor Simon Callow. He's written a new biography of Orson Welles. We'll talk more in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Back with Simon Callow. He's written the first in a two-volume biography of Orson Welles. Callow is an actor who played the villain in Ace Ventura, When Nature Calls, the character who is buried in Four Weddings and a Funeral, and the minister in A Room with a View. In your biography of Welles, you're writing about somebody who was not only very talented, but very, very arrogant. And there is a certain arrogance, I think, that often accompanies talent. How tolerant are you of that arrogance in real life? You're obviously fascinated as a biographer, but as an actor on the set working with an arrogant colleague, do you handle that well?
Well, there's a necessary arrogance and there's an unnecessary arrogance. And On the whole, the unnecessary arrogance tends to come from insecurity. The necessary arrogance comes from just a clear idea of what you want to do and a determination to get there. So, for example, Jim Carrey, with whom I acted in a film last year, is necessarily arrogant. He's absolutely clear about what he wants to do. It'll take as long as it takes. He works it out in extreme and careful detail and is prepared to make everybody wait till that's right, because he knows that he's at the centre of the film. If his performance doesn't work, then forget it, burn the film. But the other kind of arrogance, the sort of affected arrogance, which is to do with making everybody know that you're the most important person there, is loathsome. And I've rarely experienced that from really talented people, to be honest.
Which did Wells have?
Well, Wells had he had a necessary arrogance. Sometimes when he was insecure or under pressure, he behaved with the unnecessary variety. He could be very tough and wanton towards people, especially later. He could be really brutal to people in subservient positions, which is not a nice trait. I mean, one understands that the kind of pressure that he might have been under, but it's really not acceptable, in my view, to take out your own frustration on hapless, innocent bystanders.
Do you think that fame tends to bring out that unnecessary form of arrogance because people are used to being catered to?
Well, there's a very strange... this is an observation about perhaps the American cinema. Because it's such... The polarization is so extreme between the stars and everybody else, even financially, you know. Even the person playing the second lead in a part will be paid so much less than the person who's playing the leading part in a big Hollywood film, that I think it engenders a kind of desire for revenge at the lower echelons. And people think, I'm going to be a star one day, and when I am a star, I'm going to take it out on all these people. And there's a very strange... development there, sort of, it's to do with protecting your position and insisting on it and making it absolutely clear that you are the star, which is, it's not nice.
Have you had to deal with that on the set?
I have.
And
I'm naming no names, but
that's fine. But how do you deal with it? Do you just try to like sigh and let it go, or does it really make you angry and resentful?
It makes you angry and resentful, and you have to sigh and let it go. There is nothing to be done about it, unfortunately. And you always make a vow, I will never find myself in this position again. And then somebody calls through and asks you to play a part and offers you enough money to make it attractive, and so you do it.
Well, sure, you might never work again if you always turned down vehicles in which there was a temperamental star.
Exactly. And, of course, you never know. I mean, unless you've worked with somebody before.
I have one last question for you. Do you think you would have liked working with Orson Welles?
I wouldn't have failed to have been exhilarated by him. I would certainly probably have been frustrated by him for his many peccadilloes, like not turning up to rehearsals at all, or turning up to rehearsals drunk, or preferring not to rehearse, preferring instead to tell anecdotes. That probably would have driven me mad. I think I would have enjoyed it a great deal. Probably, and particularly if he'd enjoyed my work, which he might have done or might not have done. If he did like your work, then he was the most wonderful audience, absolutely gloried in what you did and enabled you to make the best use of your impulses. So if you had an idea for something, for a way of playing a scene or perhaps a way of staging it, he would take that idea on and double its impact. That's glorious, you know, for an actor. It's the happiest relationship with a director. He might, on the other hand, be rather different temperamentally, and I think he would have rather resisted the various sort of journeys that I like to try to make with character. And in that sense, I would have probably been much happier working with Charles Laughton, who had actually some rather elegant ideas about staging, but was above all interested in exploring the human heart.
As you've said, Orson Welles in his life took a very creative approach to the truth.
Yes.
It's kind of interesting thing to write about in a biography. It's a really frustrating thing to deal with in a person in real life.
Indeed, yes. Indeed. It must have been... and yet, on the other hand, it's going to be absolutely enchanting because...
sure, if they're taken out to dinner and regaling you with anecdotes.
But... Well, exactly. And also, you know, I think literally, the moment something had happened to Wells, it started to be transformed in his mind into a more vivid version of the same. I've come to the conclusion that his attitude to the truth was the way it was because the truth is uncontrollable. The truth is the truth. It's an objective thing. But if you make up a story about what's happened to you, it's yours. You can control it. You can change it. You can modify it. You're in command of it. And I think that is essentially what Wells wanted, because it's mystifying that he just literally doesn't like the truth. He has an aversion to the truth, whether it's in his favour or not. Even if he comes well out of the truth, he doesn't like it. He prefers the invention. It's a very interesting syndrome.
I guess you could say that's also connected to his work in the theatre, trying to make everything into something theatrical or into... art,
well,
you know, transforming it in some way, the way art does.
Exactly. I mean, you know the famous essay of Oscar Wilde's The Decay of the Art of Lying, which is exactly about the essentially mendacious nature of the artist. The artist always tells a lie, but it is, in Jean Cocteau's famous phrase, a lie which reveals the truth. That would be very much Wells's view. I think Wells viewed the truth per se as an extremely unreliable guide to reality.
Simon Callow is the author of Orson Welles' The Road to Xanadu. It's the first of two volumes. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Bentham, Chris Fraley, and Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.